having established that we have implied terms and express terms, having established that express terms appear on the face of the contract, and that express terms are broken down into two categories, namely condition and warranty, and we have defined what a condition is, we have defined what a warranty is, we are now going to look at how you are able to determine whether a term is either a warranty or a condition. So, first point is that the classification as to condition or warranty depends on the intention of the parties, but in many cases their intention is not expressed and the clause will not obviously be a condition or warranty. So here again, intention becomes critical, and we realize that intention is a main ingredient of contract formation. So to put it very simply, you can have a contract, a written one, and you can see the word condition used in relation to describing a term. You can see the word warranty used in terms of defining a term of the contract. But then that term is not a condition and that term is not a warranty. So just using the words does not determine whether the clause is in fact a condition or a warranty. And if it is unclear from the face of it that it's a warranty or a condition, it is called an intermediate term. It is an innominate term. So you have condition, you have warranty, and you have intermediate or innominate term, which means you can determine from the language whether it is a condition or it is a warranty. So they remain unclassified until the seriousness of the breach can be judged. So you're not going to know what category they fall into until there's a breach of contract. So if the breach goes to the root of the contract, depriving the plaintiff of the major benefits of the contract, then the relevant term will be classified as a condition. Because remember, a condition goes to the root, it goes to the heart of the contract. So the case that illustrates this point of innominate or indeterminate term is Hong Kong First Shipping and Kawasaki Kisen Keisha. And here, the facts of the case, pretty straightforward. A ship was delivered on a 24-month charter party, and it was unseaworthy, and it took 7 months to prepare. And the question is, was this length of time for repair that was out of the contract, was this a condition or was it a warranty? And bear in mind that if it's a condition, then the party that is affected, the innocent party, would then be entitled to cancel the contract and sue for damages. If it is a warranty, then the person would only be entitled for damages. And if you're going to apply the test, the question is, did 7 months rob this party of a substantial amount of time? Did it rob that person of all the benefits or 90% of the benefits of the contract? That is really what is being asked here. And the court said that many contractual undertakings could not be categorized simply as conditions or warranty, and the innocent party should be entitled to rescind only if the effect of the breach is to substantially deprive him of the benefit of the contract. So the ship was available for for 17 out of 24 months. So this is another way to look at it. So in one perspective, 7 months downtime, but in another perspective, 7 months, 17 months uptime. So if you compare the 17 months versus the 7 months, which of it is more beneficial as opposed to which of it is more damaging? And therefore, on the basis of this analysis, it was viewed that this was a warranty and not a condition, and therefore you could not rescind, you could not terminate the contract. Okay, so again, let's go back to the definition of condition, since Safia is saying that she's not clear on the distinction between them. So a condition is a substantial term, which is a vital term that goes to the root of the contract, breach of which entitles the innocent party to terminate the contract and to sue for damages. Do you understand that statement, Safia? A warranty is a subsidiary term, breach of which entitles the innocent party to damages, which is monetary compensation for loss suffered. So to come to the difference between the two, first difference is that if it's a condition, you can end the contract and seek monetary compensation. If it's a warranty, you can only seek monetary compensation. Is that clear? So it therefore means that if the term is a warranty and you, the innocent party, now decide to terminate the contract, you run the risk of being sued for breach of contract. Is that understood? The party who is the innocent party, when there's a breach of condition, can end the contract and sue for damages, and that person cannot be sued. Is that clear? Or put it differently, if they were to be sued, then they certainly would win the case. So I'm saying in the case of a condition, if the innocent party, the party who is not in breach, elects to terminate the contract and sue for damages, they would be successful and they could not in turn be sued. And if they are sued, they are going to win. Is that clear? So, and the case here of Hong Kong Fur Shipping and Kawasaki Kisen is making the point about an intermediate term. So the intermediate or the inanimate term is simply that we can't tell whether it is a fish or a fowl, whether it is condition or warranty, until there's a breach of contract. So in this particular case, a ship was chartered, it was hired, it was leased, it was rented for 24 months. 7 months out of that, it had to be in the dry dock getting repaired. And the question is, the persons who rented the ship, can they end this contract and sue for damages? And the answer is no. And the answer is no, because of the 24 months, they had 17 months to use the ship. So yes, they suffered some loss for the 7 months that the ship was out of commission, but how would that 7 months be addressed? How would they remedy the 7 months that they suffered loss for? Compensation, monetary compensation, right? Damages, yes. So they are entitled to compensation, but they are not entitled to end the contract. So remember, we're looking at express terms And we're looking, and what we have said is that express terms are those terms that are on the face of the contract. You take up the contract and reading it, those are the terms that are on the face of it. And we are saying that those terms fall into three categories. One, condition. Two, warranty. Three, innominate or indeterminate terms, meaning we don't know whether it's condition or it is warranty until there is a breach of that particular term. Then we will know. Right? So we have a saying in Jamaica, how water walk got pumpkin belly. Right? So the point is that when the contract is breached, then you will know a water walk got pumpkin belly, whether it is warranty or it is condition. So the point that is also being made is that the use of the word themselves, there's no magic to the use of the words, because somebody can describe a term in a contract as a condition, but in effect it is a warranty, and the reverse is true. Somebody can describe a term in a condition as in a contract as a warranty, but the effect of it is a condition, right? So if breach of a term expressed to be a condition can only produce a small loss, now pay attention, it may be held that the breach will not justify rescission. And this is what we saw in Hong Kong First Shipping case just now. So the breach was small compared to the length of the contract. 24 months, 7 months out of it, the ship was not working. Did that justify rescission? Yes or no? Well, according to them, yes, it didn't justify rescission. So on that basis, what they were entitled to was compensation, monetary damages for loss suffered. Monetary compensation for loss suffered. And in that regard, because it was just compensation that they were entitled to, the courts found that that was a warranty and not a condition. So the simple point is that if the loss suffered or if the breach is minor, chances are the term that is breached is a warranty and not a condition. You cannot terminate a contract for a breach of warranty. The only thing you can do is to get compensation. You can terminate a contract for a breach of condition and get compensation. And we are saying that if you're not sure whether is a warranty or a breach, then it falls into the category of indeterminate term or innominate term, and you will know what it is when there is a breach of the term. So here's another case to illustrate the point. And I hope that you will see the point I'm making in terms of the use of the word more clearly with this case. So in Wickman and Schuler, it was, and note the quotation, so this statement in quote here is an actual wording of the contract. And it says, a condition of a 4-year agreement that a representative of the plaintiff should visit 6 named customers once a week to solicit orders. So this here is the term of the contract. Are you with me? This is what is written in the contract document. Do you recognize any word in that statement? It uses the word condition, right? And remember our definition of condition. So it is using the word condition, and therefore it is intended by this person who has written this contract that if this term is breached, the person can terminate the contract and sue for damages. Let's see what happens. So the plaintiff failed to make some of the required visits. And the defendant did what? They terminated the contract. Now remember that if it is a condition in the true sense, then the defendant would have been entitled to terminate the contract and sue for damages. But here now, the person who has been terminated is now suing the person who terminated them. Is that clear? So it went to court, obviously. And what did the courts decide? The courts held that the plaintiff could recover damages for wrongful termination. Now, bear in mind, you know, this clause here used the word condition. Right? And the person acting on it terminated the contract and was claiming damages. Now, why did the court rule in the way they did? And here's the reason. It was not likely that the parties intended that failure to make a few visits out of a total of over 1,400 visits could justify rescission. So when you drill down into the case, the person made 1,400 visits and they might have missed 6 visits and they were terminated and damages were being sought against them. So they in turn sued and said, look, although this term here use the word condition, I missed 6 visits. I did 1,400 visits. Is that a fundamental breach to the extent where you have been deprived of a substantial benefit of the contract? And the answer to that question based on the decision was no. Now, so remember, we're looking at express terms. We have identified at least 3 categories of express terms. 1, condition. 2, warranty. 3, intermediate term or innominate term, because we don't know whether is a condition or a warranty, even though the word is being used. So, on the occasions the party will classify terms as condition, which in the absence of agreement would be treated as warranties, right? So this now is how the term operate. Because remember that in contract, you have 2 parties or you have multiple parties, but they are seeking to find a mutually beneficial ground in most instances. So, for example, in a commercial contract, a delivery date for goods is normally regarded as very important and will be assumed to be a condition, especially if the good is time sensitive, meaning it have an expiry date, right? So it doesn't make any sense you bring wasted items or spoiled items come when you know very well that you want it fresh so it can be sold. Now, the other example is the deadline for a payment is not necessarily as important. And in that context, it would normally be viewed as a warranty. And I like to use the example of utility bills. Because if you don't pay your utility bills on time, what happens? If you don't pay your flow bill, even though they're unreliable, if you don't pay your Digicel bill, if you don't pay your GPS bill, if you don't pay your water bill, what happens? Disconnection and late fees, right? But disconnection. But if they disconnect your utility, has the contract come to an end? No. The contract is very much still alive. And this is the point that is being made. A warranty, a breach of warranty, incurs penalties, or let me not use the word penalties. A breach of warranty incur damages or monetary compensation for loss suffered. But it does not end in the repudiation of the contract. So the contract is very much alive and the service will be restored once the relevant fees are paid, right? So that's the point I'm making. Now, here is an example of a condition. And any time you pick up a contract and you see this phrase, it means it is a condition. And the phrase is, time is of the essence of the contract. So if the parties make time of payment of the essence of the contract, then it becomes a condition, right? So for instance, in land matters, where land is being purchased or sold, usually the lawyer or the vendor puts in there that time shall be of the essence of the contract. And if you see that, it therefore means that any time there is a obligation to be made, and specifically in terms of money being paid, if that money is not paid within that time frame, then the risk is that the contract will be cancelled and the monies that are paid over forfeited. Right? Anytime you say time is of the essence of the contract. So that means that it is a condition and not a warranty. So we look at Lombard, North Central, and Butterworth. Here, an agreement for the hire of computers stated that prompt payment was of the essence. The hirer was late paying one installment, and the courts held this to be a breach of condition entitling the owner to treat the contract as at an end, repossess the computer, and claim damages for breach of contract. Right? So this is an example of a term that is express and it is a condition. And time of the essence must be expressed for it to be a condition. And if it is so expressed, then it is definitely going to bring about termination and compensation. So that now brings us to implied terms. So remember what we have said is that there are two broad categories of terms in a contract. Express terms, which are on the face of the contract, and then implied terms, which you must read between the lines. So it's not written there, but the contract can't function without these unsaid terms. Now, in addition to terms which the parties to a normal contract have expressly adopted, there may be others imported in the contract from its context. These implications may be derived from custom, and we are familiar with the word custom from the time we did sources of law until now, or may rest upon statute, or may be inferred by the judges to reinforce the language of the parties and realize their manifest intention. So all of these are ways that implied terms can be imported into the contract. So by custom, by statute, or by case law, right? The judge taking into account the circumstances of the transaction. So here now, we look at each of them in turn. So implied terms by way of custom. So a contract may be subject to terms that are sanctioned by custom, whether commercial or otherwise, although they have not been expressly mentioned by the parties. And in this particular instance, we have the case of British Crane Hire and Ipswich Plant Hire. So both firms were in the business of hiring out cranes and heavy plant. The defendants urgently needed a crane for work on marshy ground and agreed to hire such a crane from the plaintiffs. The method of payment was agreed, but the hire condition were not. The plaintiffs then sent the defendant a copy of their standard conditions, which were similar to those used throughout the trade. So remember, we talk about custom now, you know. And custom relate to business practices, culture. So here in the tourism sector, the tourism industry, they may have a certain language or culture that they talk and they understand. In customs, there's a language that they thought they understand. So here's heavy duty is their business, so they understand. So in their copy of their agreement, the standard conditions, which provided that the IRA would be liable for all expenses arising out of the use of the crane. So whoever is hiring the crane pay the expenses. So before they signed off on these conditions, the crane sank in marshy ground. But remember, they didn't sign on the dotted line yet, but they had the crane and they were working the crane, and the crane sank. And the plaintiffs, of course, incurred the expenses in recovering it. The plaintiffs claimed these expenses from the defendant. And the plaintiffs succeeded in their action since both parties were in the same trade and had equal bargaining power, and the evidence was that they both understood that the plaintiff's standard conditions of hire would apply. Does anyone understand what is happening here and wish to tell us?
Sir?
Yes.
I think because, as you say, they're in the same field, so maybe the plaintiff is saying the defendant would have understood the circumstance, if the environment was not conducive to what they were doing, then the crane would have sunk. So they, having that information, then they didn't make a prudent decision. So they were being held liable because of that, I suppose.
Okay, so I believe you have the substance of it. So yes, they're in the same field, they understand the language of the same field, they understood that if the crane had been damaged, or if it, in this case, it sunk and had to be retrieved, that they, the persons who are hiring the crane, would have to pay those expenses. That was part of the understanding. So when the crane sank, the plaintiffs, who are the persons suing, who hired out the crane, asked the defendants who hired the crane to pay them for the retrieval of the crane, and they refused. And therefore, they had to sue them. And the court said, look, this was a condition of the agreement, and you understood it. It was an implied term of the agreement, and you understood it to be an implied term because you are in the same field as these persons. So, as I said, you have the substance of it, right? So that is an example of terms being implied. So to go back to the point, this wasn't written. They hadn't signed on anything on the dotted line explaining this thing, but it was the practice in the particular field, in the particular business, and it was understood by all the parties, right? So that is term implied by custom. Now we look at terms implied by the courts. And let me... So how does this now work? So the courts will imply two types of terms into a contract. So terms implied in fact, that is terms which are so obvious that the parties must have intended them to be included. So remember, implied terms now are not written in the contract, right? You're reading between the lines now. And the contract can't function unless these terms are part of it. So if it's implied by fact, terms implied by law. So terms which are implied to maintain a standard of behavior, even though the parties may not have intended to include them. So the term implied must be both obvious and necessary to give business efficacy to a contract. The courts will not imply a term merely because it is reasonable to do so. So there must be some necessity. So the test here is what we call in law the officious bystander. And what we would have met the reasonable person or the reasonable man or the reasonable woman before, this is a similar test to the reasonable person, man or woman. So it is the person who is looking on. They are not party to the contract, but they're looking on and they are saying, well, that must be a term of the contract because otherwise the contract couldn't work. So when the contract is put to them and they look at the situation, their response is going to be, yes, obviously, this must have been a part of this contract. It didn't have to be spelled out. It is so obvious. And the case that illustrates that point is the Moorcock case. And here, the defendants, who were wharf owners, contracted to allow the plaintiffs to unload their ship at the wharf. The ship grounded at low water and was damaged by settling on a ridge of hard ground. So what's happening here, ship is coming into this harbor and the owners of the harbor, the owners of the wharf, should have said to the ship owners, say, look here, your ship is too big to come here. The water is too shallow. So they didn't put them on notice. They said, yes, man, come and dock your ship. The ship came in, ship ran aground, and the ship got damaged. And of course, the ship owners now sued the wharf owners, and they held that there was a breach of implied term that the wharf was safe. Because the reality is that if they knew that the ship was too big or the air was too shallow, they should have not accepted them coming in. So the idea is that they didn't tell them point blank, say, well, yes, we're deep enough for you to get inside here, but they did say to come. And therefore, the idea is once they gave that signal, it is implied that the wharf was safe and it could manage a ship of that size. So, term implied by the courts. So again, another case illustrating the point, and this one might be a little bit controversial and contradictory. So here in Ayr and Meads Day, the plaintiff underwent a sterilization operation, and obviously we're talking about a female here who decided that she don't want to have any more children, so she's tying her tubes. So the surgeon had advised her that the operation was irreversible, and consequently the plaintiff believed that she would be sterile. So the fact that there was a slight risk of pregnancy after the operation was not pointed out. Later, the plaintiff became pregnant and gave birth to a son. And of course, she now sued the doctor because this wasn't her expectation. And it was held that the word irreversible did not amount to a guarantee of success. It merely indicated that the procedure could not be reversed, which is quite different. Right, so essentially they're saying that there was no implied term here that the operation was irreversible and that she could never get pregnant again. So applying the officious bystander test, the court said that although it would be reasonable for the plaintiff to assume that she was sterile, it would not be reasonable for her to think she had been given a guarantee that she was sterile. So I hope you can see the thinness of the argument there. But clearly, they are making the point that there was no implied term here that she would never be pregnant again. So if she had wanted such a guarantee, she should have asked for it, is what the courts have said. I don't think that would necessarily be successfully argued in today's world, but be that as it may. The plaintiff was therefore unsuccessful. So the lady who had this baby that she probably thought she would never have again was not successful in this particular case. And essentially what she was seeking to do was to say there's an implied undertaking or an implied commitment guarantee from the doctor that this was a foolproof process. So we continue to look at terms implied by the courts. And terms implied in law cover many classes of contracts. And so for instance, these contract of employment, employee, impliedly undertakes, for example, to be faithful, serve his employer, and that she will be reasonably skilled, he or she. The employer impliedly undertakes that he or she will not require the employer to do an unlawful act, and that he or she will provide safe premises. Landlord and tenant, when it come on to repair, when it come on to quiet possession, when it come on to not committing waste, meaning you don't go into the people in place and damage it, but you take care of it. All of these are implied in law. So when you take up the Landlord and Tenant Act, for instance, you'll see talk about repair, and it will talk about the responsibility of the landlord vis-a-vis the responsibility of the tenant. Well, and they would argue that they did so. Now, so we continue to look again at terms implied by the courts. So here, Liverpool City Council and Irwin, and this is just showing you the principle, again using landlord and tenant as the backdrop, it was held that where parts of a building have been let to different tenants, and where right of access over parts of the building retained by the landlord, example the stairs, have been granted to these tenants, then a term would be implied that the landlord would keep those areas reasonably safe, right? So you have I don't want to call it a tenement situation, but you know, you have multiple tenants in a premises that have common area. It is not the tenants who will necessarily be responsible for maintaining the common area. It's likely to be the landlord, worse if that landlord lives in the said premises. And that is really implied in law. So if it is that there's a contract and the contract is silent on repairs, then the Landlord and Tenant Act will imply and indicate who is responsible for what repairs. So, terms implied by statute. And here, we have the Sales of Goods Act, which we will see. And one of the implied terms is that the seller has the right to sell. And that if there's a sale by description, it is implied that the goods shall correspond with the description. And if it is sale by sample, the same thing is implied that the sample will correspond with the bulk, right? And you are fully well aware that we will be looking at the Sales of Goods Act when we have completed the contract law, because that is a specialty contract, and we'll observe from it that in relation to the sales of goods, that there are many principles that are in contract law that are codified in the Sales of Goods Act. So we are gonna hold it there for this evening, and when we come back on Tuesday of next week, we will look at exemption clauses, because these are special clauses. So remember, now we're looking at the terms of the contract, and we have distinguished between what is a term as opposed to what is a representation, or you can put it this way, when a statement is simply a representation as opposed to a term of the contract. We have looked at the four tests that need to be applied to make that distinction. We have looked at the terms, whether terms are express or implied. If they are express terms, then they fall into one of three categories: condition, warranty, intermediate term. And if they are implied term, then they are implied either by custom, either by courts, either by statute. And we must be able to give an example of these terms and how we can tell the difference between them. So when we come back, we continue under the topic of content of contract, and we will look at a special category of terms which are called exemption clauses and how these exemption clauses end up in contract. So that's it. If there are any questions, feel free to ask them, and we certainly will answer. Yes, the question keeps coming about the mid-semester exam. I will advise through the groups or through the chat when... Oh, by the way, I am saying next week Thursday, but we have class on Thursday. Right. So when we come on Thursday, I will tell you when that date is. Right? And on Thursday, we will deal with the matter here of exemption clauses. Yes, so see you Thursday evening, 8 to 9. So we look now at the contents of contracts, right? So we turn our attention now to the content of contract. So the idea here is that we have done the preliminaries. We have checked to see whether all the elements of contract are in place. And we are satisfied that we have all the elements in place. We are satisfied that there has been a valid offer. We're satisfied that there has been a valid acceptance. We're satisfied that there's good consideration. We're satisfied that there was intention to create a legally binding relationship. And we're satisfied that there is capacity to contract. So having reached this point, the question now is, what are the content of the contract? What are the contents of the contract? And we need to now determine what these are. So we're going to essentially be looking at the body of the contract. So we, in looking at the body of the contract, what we're seeking to do here is to determine the extent of the obligations that it carries. What is each party to do? And in order to do that, we have to establish what the terms the parties have expressly included in the contract. So that's the first thing you're going to look at. What are the terms that the parties have expressly included in the contract? And when you say they have expressly included it in the contract, what we are saying is that when you take up the contract, if it is written and you read it, these are the things that are on the face of the contract, right? Because remember that a contract can be verbal, it can be in writing, it can be by conduct, right? But it is best if you put it in writing. And as I've said, the express terms are those that appear on the face of it. So not all terms are going to appear on the face of the contract. Some of these terms will be implied. And a good example when we talk about implied terms is when we use the phrase, let us look again at the circumstances. So the court will not enforce an exemption clause unless the party affected by it was adequately informed of it when he or she accepted it. Thus, the exemption clause must be put forward in a document which gives reasonable notice of the liability condition proposed by it. So two things are happening here. So here, where writing is important, so this exemption clause must be in writing, And the second element is the question of reasonable notice, which has been a theme throughout exemption clauses to make them effective. So the idea here is that persons must not be ambushed into arrangements that they have no knowledge of. So in Chapleton and Barry UDC, there was a pile of chairs and a notice saying hire of chairs 2 pence per session of 3 hours. The plaintiff took 2 chairs, paid for them, and received 2 tickets. One of the chairs collapsed and he was injured. The council relied on a notice on the back of the tickets by which it disclaimed liability for injury. It was held that the notice advertising chairs for hire gave no warning of limiting conditions and it was not reasonable to communicate them on a receipt. The disclaimer of liability was not effective. And, you know, when we come to look at the Consumer Protection Act, one of the things that we're going to find is that the Act limits exemption or exclusion clauses when it comes on to the question of liability for personal injuries. So that the common law essentially decided here that it would not be fair in these circumstances to have that exclusion clause applied because the person didn't get adequate notice of the danger that they would face. Now, that case is contrasted with this one, which is Thompson LMS Railway, where an elderly lady who could not read asked her niece to buy her a railway excursion ticket on which was printed excursion. For conditions, see back. On the back of it was stated that the ticket was issued subject to conditions contained in the company's timetables. These conditions excluded liability for injury. It was held that the conditions had been adequately communicated and therefore accepted. So that one is the pole opposite of the previous one that we saw. But what I'd like to point out here in relation to the difference is that the nature of the business excursions, right? And if anyone who has gone on a bus tour, whether here in Jamaica or across Europe, it would be known that there's always the danger of accidents, right? That's a possibility. So that even before you were to purchase the ticket, you would be put on notice that if you get on these buses, you're going on road trips, there is always the possibility that there could be an accident. And therefore, in putting the notice on the excursion ticket, that would not have been unreasonable. And in any event, unlike the previous case having to do with the chairs, this was brought to their attention prior to the purchase of the ticket, or at least it would have been in their minds prior to going on this excursion, right? So a further distinction between the two cases is that in the Chapleton case, the ticket was a mere receipt. It did not purport to set out the conditions for the hire of the chair. It only showed the time for which it was hired and at a fee, and that a fee had been paid. However, in Thompson's case, it would have been obvious to a reasonable person that the ticket had contractual effect, since tickets of that kind generally contain contract terms. But that comes back, when it's a ticket of that kind, it also comes back to the nature of the business. So for instance, you know, if people go to amusement parks, whether here in Jamaica or overseas, you know, sometimes you're asked to sign an indemnity. If you have had the occasion to go to Westport or whatever they call it out in Negril, Westmoreland, they are going to ask you questions whether you suffer from any back pain, any heart conditions, and so on. And they'll ask you to sign an indemnity so that if you go on the ride and you lie to them and you are injured, then you will have to face the liability. Or they will limit their liability based on what you would have said in those things. Likewise, if you go to Mystic Mountain, these questions may be put and they may be asked of you. And that is a way that persons can limit their exposure to liability if persons are injured. So now that brings us to, I think this is the sixth one. Circumstance under which the exemption clause or exclusion clause may be incorporated into a contract. So if the parties have had long and consistent dealings on terms incorporating an exemption clause, then the clause may apply to a particular transaction even if the usual steps to incorporate it were not taken. If there are only a few transactions spread over a long period, it would not be reasonable to assume that the person had agreed to the terms. So, again, the point that is being made here is if there's a history between the parties, that you know how the business operates, then if you know that there's an exclusion clause, that exclusion clause would be applicable even if at that particular transaction notice had not been brought to your attention, as opposed to somebody who has been using the service intermittently and really would not know for any significant period of time the modus operandi of the particular entity. So in that instance, that entity would need to bring to the attention of the party the challenge that they are facing. And this is actually the sixth circumstance under which an exclusion clause may be incorporated into a contract. So the case here is Hollier and Rambler Motors. On three or four occasions over a period of 5 years, the plaintiff had repairs done at the garage. On each occasion, he had signed a form by which the garage disclaimed liability for damage caused by fire to customers' cars. On the last occasion, he did not sign the form. The car was damaged by fire caused by the negligence of the garage employees. The garage contended that the disclaimer had, by course of dealing, become an established term of any contract between them and the plaintiff. It was held that the garage was liable. There was insufficient evidence to show that the plaintiff knew of and agreed to the condition as a continuing term of his contract with the garage. So that illustrates the point that we made just now. But I also want to say that in addition to the exemption clause and the lack of notice being the basis, the issue of negligence is also one to be considered. And negligence is a tort, right, which is a civil wrong. So the reality is that apart from, as I have said, really, that exemption clauses are not absolute. So the point is that the courts will be interested in balancing what is just in the circumstances, but outside of what is just in the circumstances is also the cause of action. So one could sue the person for breach of contract, but they could also sue them in tort for negligence. And depending on the angle that you take in relation to the matter, you may have a more fruitful or more positive outcome, as in this particular case. So yes, the exemption clause was there, but again, based on the principle, this person had not been a customer of sufficient recurrence in order for them to claim that they should know that this is the standard operating procedure of the company and that the company is seeking to be exempted from damage caused by fire. But in this instance also, the issue of negligence looms very large. So that's the point that I want to make. Now, so that essentially covers the exemption clauses, and what we have seen is that there are several circumstances under which exemption clauses may find themselves in the contractual arrangement. And in fact, if you were to count the instances, there are actually six of them that we just covered. And, you know, this is a live area when it comes on to the content of contract. And it generally finds itself in the final exam. Now, so we have seen this topic before, incomplete contract. We actually saw it when we dealt with the elements of contract. And one of the reasons why it came up when we were dealing with elements of contract is that we said that the offer must be definitive. It must be definite. It must be certain. So when somebody puts an offer on the table, you must know exactly what they are speaking about. So if the offer is unclear and uncertain, then it may have implication for the contract. And therefore, a general rule is that for a contract to be legally binding, it must be complete in its terms. There must be no ambiguity in relation to what the parties have agreed. So the case of Scamwell and Austin, here, their agreement for the purchase of a van provided for the balance of the price to be paid over 2 years on higher purchase terms. It was held that there was no agreement since it was unclear that terms of payment were in. It was uncertain what terms of payment were intended. Higher purchase terms may vary over intervals between payment rates of interest and so on. So the point here, of course, is that to use the phrase higher purchase don't really mean nothing, because every higher purchase agreement is different. It has different arrangements, different schedules, different interest payments, and so on. So this essentially was uncertain. There was no definitive nature to the phrase, and therefore the court said, look, this is not an agreement. So again, you know, we are saying that as part and parcel of a valid agreement, that agreement as between the parties must be crystal clear. The courts are not going to try to go into people's mind. Now, that doesn't mean that in all circumstances when things are not as clear as they ought to be, that the court is going to find that there is no contract. So if the parties leave an essential term to be settled by specific means outside the contract, and an example here that they may agree to sell at the prevailing open market price, if there's a market. So for instance, if there's a market for commodities, you can go and you can check. So there's a commodity market for gold, commodity market for silver, commodity market for aluminum, and a range of other products. So if the contract is in relation to those items or that type of market, and it makes reference to the mechanism by which you can find the price, then in those circumstances, the court is likely to find that there is a contract. And if it is that these parties have had previous dealings and there's a history between them, and you can tell the way in which they have arrived at a particular price, then the court may find that there is a contract. And just to point out that in these instances, when you come on to the price may very well be the consideration, right? Now, so the case that illustrates this is Hillas and Arcus. And in this case, a contract for the supply of timber in 1930 contained an option for the purchaser to buy a quantity of timber in 1931, but made no reference to the price. It was held that the missing term of the 1931 purchase could be deducted from the conduct of the parties in their 1930 transaction when the price was determined by reference to an official price list. So in other words, there was a mechanism by which the court could arrive at the price, and therefore they found that in those circumstances the contract was valid, although one could argue was incomplete. Now, the other circumstance is if the parties use non-essential words, for example, standard printed conditions, some of which are inappropriate, such words may be disregarded. So in Nicolene and Simmons, a contract provided that the usual conditions of acceptance apply. However, there were no usual conditions of acceptance. It was held that this phrase was non-essential and meaningless. It could therefore be ignored. And in ignoring the use of these words, a contract essentially was found. Now, the reality is that in our modern day and age, we have a lot of what are now called standard form contracts. And can anyone give me an example of what would be considered a standard form contract? Anybody else? Remember what we're talking about now, you know. I don't know how we're getting parking tickets and movie tickets. Parking ticket, no. Right? Parking ticket is a parking ticket would be more of a penalty, it's not a contract. You breach something and you get a ticket. So,
sir?
Yes.
Sir?
Yeah, man, I'm hearing you. Go ahead.
A contract between two companies. I was asking about a contract between two companies that would have been made from, like, a template.
Well, you're warm in terms of a template. A lease would be a good example. Yes, a lease. That's a good one. Your answer, bank saving account form, I'd say warm. Warm because you mentioned banks, that's a Maya. Well, no, I wouldn't go with tender as a standard form contract. Think about consumer loans. Think about credit cards, right? Think about mortgages. Those are standard form. Right, so we have building societies, people going and they get mortgages, people going and they get car loans. devices, yes, contract for phones, right? Yes, devices, contract. So the idea is this, is that these are common services that are utilized by many persons, right? And when people go in, is really the form is already there and you just sign on the dotted line. There's really no room for negotiations, and in a sense it's a sort of take it or leave it approach if you're not careful, because the entities have the unequal bargaining power then, right? So when you think about a car loan and all these promotions that are going on, they're basically offering various packages to persons, and the only thing that is really going to change is the name of the person, the address of the person, the occupation of the person's TRN, and depending on the vehicle, the monthly deduction that is going to come out. So these are standard form things. Likewise, again, if you go through a bank to get a mortgage, the mortgage instrument is essentially the same. And again, what is different is the names of the persons, probably the tenure of the mortgage and so on. But all of these documents are pretty much standardized, and you are just signing on the dotted line. And of course, what is important is the wording of the documents. And as we have said, it makes sense for you to read them carefully. And especially in the case of, what you'd call it now, mortgages, what you find is that companies usually send the mortgagor to the to get independent legal advice, right? And essentially they give you a form that you take to the attorney, and what that form is going to say, that they have read over the document to you and you understand it. Right, and they do that because in the event you should default on the loan, then they are going to come and foreclose on that property. And you can't then say, well, you signed it, but you did not know what you signed, right? So that is really an example of what is a standard form contract, and it is done because of the commercialization of much of what we do today. I like the response about devices, especially in more developed markets where you have a fierce competition for customers. You will get a handset, but then they say the handset is free, but guess what? You are locked into a 2-year contract to use their services, right? And again, if you read the terms of the contract, they are pretty much the same, and that is what we mean when we say standard form. We simply mean that the terms are essentially the same without much or any variation, except for the particulars of the individual who are signing on to those contractual arrangements. So that essentially would bring us to the end of the content of contract. And then what we are going to do now is move on to look at vitiating factors next week when we come back. And we look at mistake, we look at misrepresentation, and we look at duress, we look at illegality and undue influence. Are there any questions?
Sir?
Yes.
Okay.